Today, I talked to my coworker Jacob Karab about his work as a solutions architect, helping people build things out of Apache Kafka and Confluent Platform. What does a solutions architect do, you ask? Well, I'll tell you on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as ever, your host, Tim Berglund. And I'm joined in the virtual studio, which is virtual to the tune of several thousand miles today, by Jacob Karab. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you very much for having me on.
You got it. Now, Jacob is a solutions architect. He works, he's a coworker of mine here at Confluent. He's a solutions architect. If you don't know what that is, he's going to tell you. And he's also the professional services team lead for the EMEA region. That's Europe, Middle East, Africa. And we're going to be talking about professional services at Confluent today. And I want to say up front, Jacob, before I even ask you any questions, I want to ask you about your background and how you got into this role and all kinds of things. I want to say there's always a danger with this kind of topic of it sounding like a commercial, and nobody wants that. So this really, our goal here today is not to persuade you to go buy professional services from Confluent, although certainly I think you'll find Jacob presents himself in such a way that you'd be convinced it's not a bad idea to do that. But we're not like measuring conversions here on this podcast episode. However, a few things. If you don't know how an enterprise software company works, this is a key component, and it's an interesting thing to know about. And that by itself, what's PS in an enterprise software company, isn't a technical topic. But if you're a technical person, you should know that. This is just like a part of our world, and it's good to know. Second is, these are the folks who know where the bodies are buried, right? They build things out of Kafka, out of Confluent Platform, and they actually know what's going on in the world. They're interacting with real customers, trying to set up real successful projects. And so if you want to know what trends there are out in the enterprise, you ask a guy like Jacob. And that's going to come later in our conversation, that question about trends, but you're never going to find a better source. And so I wanted to say, this is not, again, nobody is measuring how many podcast listens turn into orders for professional services. It's not our goal here, but it's still really, really helpful to talk to a guy like Jacob. So Jacob, tell us about yourself. How'd you get into this role?
That is a long and very complicated journey. My background is as a programmer, as most people in this particular profession kind of tend to be.
Yes.
I originally graduated from with a software architecture degree. Sorry, not software architecture, but a software engineering degree. And worked on various things in a number of different countries. Started off in Australia and moved through Ireland and ended up living in the United Kingdom, which is where I am now in not so sunny Bristol. We had quite a storm here today. And I was programming on everything from, in telecoms through to trading systems at investment banks. After about 10 years, I decided, look, this is... This programming stuff, I'd like to try something a little bit different. And what I ended up doing was working as a consultant for a number of open source software companies. And in that sort of role, I was going from customer to customer, talking to them about how to implement the products that we were working with. There were a number of different products from Apache and various other foundations. And basically how to realize business value out of all of this stuff. So after a while of doing this, I ran my own company for a while, working in much of the same sort of field for about 5 years. I wrote a couple of books in that time. So
tell us about those books.
Well,
if they're still current enough that you like talking about.
They're current enough. They're current enough. And a lot of people still read them, which I'm very pleased about. So one was the Apache Developers Cookbook. So my professional background was messaging and integration. And this was a very useful little tool set. And it still continues to be a very useful tool set, which is continuously evolving. And then I had the pleasure of writing a book for O'Reilly on... which was called Understanding Message Brokers. And it's one of those, 70-page type books that you might hand out at various conferences in order to give people a better than superficial understanding of a particular subject area. And in this particular case, it was comparing traditional message brokers to the next generation of you know, what was at the time referred to as a message broker, but is now an event streaming platform. And that was with Kafka, kind of comparing the different access mechanisms, the different ways that it interacted with disks and all of that sort of fun stuff, and, you know, things to keep in mind and ways in which these things are not really the same thing. And after a long and winding road, I sort of ended up at Confluent, and I've been here for the last 2 years, going, you know, from customer to customer, working in everything from designing architectures through with them to doing implementations. I'm currently doing a residency at a financial exchange, so it's been quite an interesting journey throughout this entire thing.
Tell us a little bit about professional services. I think the way Confluent does this is fairly ordinary. If you look at any other subscription enterprise software business, particularly infrastructure business, this is sort of a cookie cutter thing that everybody does. Largely the same. But what are you? Are you a salesperson? Are you a programmer for hire? Do you just write PowerPoint diagrams that then somebody compiles into working software? I mean, what do you do in professional services?
I'm glad you asked. So professional services is something that all enterprise software companies have to do at some point in time. Having the greatest product in the world is all well and good. But if people don't actually know how to implement it within their context, then that's going to be a problem, right? So in professional services, we kind of have two different roles. One is solutions architects, of which I am one, and the other one is consulting engineers. And the way that I sort of describe it, if I can sort of draw the analogy to electricity, is that solutions architects are like electrical engineers. We know how to wire everything together. We have a deep working understanding of everything. And consulting engineers are like the master electricians. These people will go in and they will rewire your house. So my job as a solutions architect is to go around to various companies, listen to them in terms of, what exactly is it that you're building, and advise them on achieving the thing that they want to build, which is not always straightforward, simply because no two enterprises are the same. So even though we're dealing with a product suite that we are intimately familiar with, the details will vary on an engagement by engagement and a customer by customer basis, right? So in terms of professional services as a department, we're part of a wider group within Confluent called Customer Success. And Customer Success is all the people who you will interact with after you've decided to go off and buy the Confluent platform and engage with us for further assistance. So there's professional services, obviously, there's training, and there's customer operations, who are the good people who you will call in your hour of need, yes, when nobody else will pick up the phone.
Customer we would call them support. We say customer operations, but you'd
Absolutely. Yeah. So, in professional services, our big thing is really about helping customers achieve the business outcomes that they want using the Confluent platform, right? And the outcomes vary in as much as the drivers to using this sort of software varies. And they can be everything from competition. Let's say that you're a bank, a retail bank, and you're processing mortgage applications. And a startup has, a fintech startup has come up, and they can turn these things around in under 15 minutes, or while you're waiting there with your tablet and drinking coffee in front of the TV and that sort of thing. Well, yours takes a week. That's obviously not a comfortable position to be in. And moving to real time is a big factor. We also see a lot of customers doing things like process evolution or optimization. So let's say that you are a manufacturer. Batching things up has a real world cost. That is to say that if you have product which is sitting inside a warehouse, that is taking up warehousing space. And in a world of just-in-time manufacturing where, you're probably a supplier to other companies who are manufacturing things, these things are a big factor. So, moving to real time there, again, has quite a significant impact, right? And I guess the other thing that we see a lot of is changing business environments. So, for example, if you've got, we're seeing financial regulators requiring that, positions of accounts be sent through to them on a much more regular basis than had previously happened. So we're moving to, for example, hourly reports for financial companies as opposed to, daily or weekly. So these are all big drivers towards moving to this type of platform. And they all have very different challenges associated with them. So it's very nice to be able to kind of move across these industries and find out a little bit about, how the world works and how the world has changed.
That sounds like it's got to be the most fascinating part of the job. I mean, I know sometimes in my role, I get to meet with customers in kind of like, for me, it's more of a pre-sales role. Like, let me help you get excited about this thing. Even if it's an existing customer, maybe it's like a new group inside the company, or they're thinking of some new business unit to roll out a new use case with. I'm always there when, just through the nature of my work and developer relations, we're trying to engage technical people and provide technical answers and think through things, in terms of how we actually build things out of Confluent and out of Kafka. But it's early on, and I'm also trying to inspire and excite and so forth. Just my role, which is before you're in there to actually make things work. But you said a thing that is a thing I also love, which is just the variety of things. Like, you never know what sort of industry your next engagement is going to be. You've mentioned fintech, and like financial services tends to be, is right now, a large scale adopter of event streaming infrastructure, so that we bump into them a lot. But you don't know what you're going to find, what they're going to do. Is it going to be financial services? Is it going to be some other industry? Every engagement is just some brand new part of the world where you get to learn and fall in love with that domain.
Absolutely. And I think that is by far the most enjoyable part of the job. So as it turns out, I've become a bit of an electricity nerd for some reason. I've had the pleasure of working across a number of, I suppose, subdomains within that, where it's just been fascinating to find out just how the world works. So, we've been doing things with a company that, pulls in data from 30,000 wind turbines around the world, right? Metrics on a sub-second basis, right? We've been dealing with electricity companies who I've learned all about things like underwater interconnects, which connect the United Kingdom to the rest of the electricity market across Europe, how power generation and trading kind of end up going hand in hand, as renewable energy sources like wind and solar, which are intermittent, kind of affect energy prices and how those have to be compensated with contracts that have for contracts that have been sold for say you're doing some smelting, there's not enough sun to power the energy that's been sold, and you then need to go off and buy it from from gas or coal or something like that, and help price fluctuations can are affected by things like wind in northern Denmark. So it's just been absolutely just the most interesting, interesting journey. And you know, if any of your listeners are contemplating, you know, ever going into the wild and you know finding out how things work, you know, professional services at a company like Confluent is absolutely the way to go.
Sounds like we should include a link to our careers page in the show notes.
Absolutely.
This message has been brought to you by Confluent Sourcing. Confluent Sourcing, the best recruiting in. But no, seriously, that we will include that link. Again, not because that's purpose of the episode, but you know, it's just you're doing a good job selling this thing. Because like the electricity stuff.
It's fun.
If you're like a moderately well-informed layperson, you're aware that there are three things called generation, transmission, and distribution, right? And already, just like knowing what those words are, it feels like you know a lot about electricity. I know nothing about electricity, right? And with you getting to kind of be inside some of those businesses and learn those ins and outs, like you said, just about how the world works, that is so cool.
It is. It's great. It's really, really, you know, quite an exciting thing to work in. Yeah, it you know, on a week by week basis, it's, you know, it could be finance, it could be you know, it could be electricity trading, could be manufacturing, could be retail. It's really been one heck of a journey, right?
Nice. Well, here's a little bit of a hold your feet to the fire kind of question. Professional services in an enterprise software company is always there. You said that, and that's true. Obviously it's a source of revenue. You know, the company charges more than its costs for you. So the company makes money on your time. So what are the incentives not to make a product that needs professional services? It seems like there'd be some perverse incentive in some smoke-filled back room to say, well, let's not make the product too easy because then people won't need services. So I want to ask that I'm kind of giving you a negative framing of the question. What's the value of working with PS? Is it that, or how do you defend yourself?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I suppose you could do that if you were evil. We're clearly not evil here at Confluent. I think that there's always a gap between where a customer actually wants to be in terms of, you know, realizing business value, and where the product ends. And we're striving to kind of get that, close that gap as much as is humanly possible. But what always varies is the context. And I always keep coming back to context when I'm talking to customers, in that there are just some things that every single customer practically does differently, right? So how do you envisage managing hundreds of topics, for example, on a Kafka cluster, right?
Yeah.
Do you have some team that is going to be provisioning things for you by yourselves, by themselves? Do you want to go and move to some sort of a self-service thing? If you want to go to some form of self-service, do you want to hook it up into a CI/CD pipeline, right? What servers are you using? What sort of constraints do you have, like organizational constraints? Do you want to do some form of chargeback billing, right? Who should that stuff go to? How are you deploying all of this stuff? And the reality is that this is a significant part of any sort of an implementation project. And a few years ago, I used to work with a company that sold software in the airline industry. And they also sold a platform and they sold professional services. And they had this idea of an avocado model. And the avocado model was that if you cut an avocado in half, the seed of the avocado is the platform that you're selling. And the flesh of the avocado is all the stuff that you need to do in order to actually realize it. So you can sort of get a nice visual metaphor out of that in terms of, you know, how much additional work is required in order to successfully implement it in exactly the way that you know, you as someone who's you know, who's responsible for an enterprise like that wants and envisages within the context of your organization.
Nice. And I would summarize that just by saying that, you know, you said you could do that if you're evil. And I would add also if you don't want to win in the marketplace, because it's
absolutely,
it's just hard enough to make stuff out of computers. It's real hard to write programs and make systems that work. And particularly when you've got, you know, an actual innovation, which event streaming is, it really is a new paradigm. And these are, you know, super cliched words that Silicon Valley people use all the time, but it's real. When I talk to people who are trying to build things on event streaming and they're building their first system, they are learning a new paradigm. It's very clear. You have these very talented, perfectly capable software architects struggling to think through how to do this new thing. So, you know, yeah, you could make that harder. You could make your product harder to use. So you'd sell more services. But I think in the margins, you're going to find you sell a lot less product. So,
yeah,
you know, it's very appropriate to like do everything you can to make this as usable as possible. And people are still going to consume professional services because they just need help. And you're the only ones in the world who have done this 10 times.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you touched on a number of points there. The first one is really about the nature of the platform itself, right? These are not static things. They keep changing. We've recently had a release 5.4 within the Confluent platform. And this has been absolutely massive, and it changes a number of things. And you know, we've had to go back to the drawing board and actually look at the new feature set that's been added as part of that version. We've had to take it apart, go back over our existing designs that we've seen with other customers, and go, if we had the tools now that we did. If we had the tools then that we do now, how would that have affected our designs? Right. So we've really got our heads in this space in terms of, you know, how do you go about implementing this stuff? And this is a really big and it's a very complex platform. And I'd like to sort of, you know, draw a distinction between the terms comp and complicated. Complex simply in this case means that there are a lot of moving parts, and there are a lot of moving parts, and they're interdependent, I should say, and they're also interdependent with a bunch of other moving parts that you happen to have inside your enterprise. So this is quite a challenging job, right? From a technical viewpoint, and hugely enjoyable as a result for people like us who like solving puzzles, right?
Right, solving puzzles and building things and helping people learn to build things. That's
absolutely, absolutely.
How is that's kind of a complex question the way I'm asking it. How is professional services changing? Is professional services changing right now as you know we migrate to the cloud and other sorts of broad secular trends sort of work themselves out? And if it is changing, how?
Absolutely. So it's changing in a number of different dimensions. And it affects the way that we deliver our services, and it also affects the way that we think about a lot of these problems. So when I started about 2 years ago, the typical users were what we would term innovators or early adopters of Kafka, of the Confluent platform, and they were happy to cut their teeth on open source. And what they needed from us was workshop level guidance, so that they would, you know, present a problem to us over a couple of days. We'd discuss it with them and say, okay, well, have you tried deploying it in this particular manner? Have you considered using Kafka streams for various bits and pieces of this streaming platform that you're building, etc. And all that they needed was just to be pointed in the right general direction. And, you know, really to be told, are we doing the right thing? Right, and then they were happy to go off and build this stuff themselves. Now, what we're seeing 2 years later is I think a response to the success of the idea of a platform based on event streaming. And that is that Kafka itself has become more mainstream, right? And as a result, Confluent Platform has become more mainstream because of all of the value adds that come with it, right? So customers know that they want to use it or they must use it. They need to do so quickly, but they no longer have that open source background, right? So then the sort of interaction that they require still starts with pointing us in the right general direction, but then we have to add the ability to sort of to run beside them through things like delivery assurance. You know, are you building the right stuff? And enablement of a team. You know, one of the things about professional services is, professional services and Confluent. Confluent is not a consulting company. We're a software company, right? Our interest is in making sure that you're pointed in the right general direction, you know how to use our product, and you get value out of our products. And so what our job is in professional services as a response to that is that, you know, we need to guide customers to where they need to be to actually realize their ultimate objectives around this stuff, right?
So the change that you've seen is, when you got started a few years ago, it was more like, hey, make sure we're pointed in the right direction, and then go away, we'll handle the rest, because those were early adopters. These are
that's
people
exactly
who want you chilling and billing, to use a derogatory term. But they don't, they're not people who ever want a long-term engagement
with
some dang consulting organization. You know, they're early adopters. They have the engineering juice to do it on their own, and they just kind of want some advice, and then they'll go build it, go away.
Yeah, one of the things that we've sort of heard is, like, you know, we've got smart people. Yeah? No one's saying that you don't have smart people. Of course you've got smart people, right? Smart people, uh-huh. Smart people work everywhere. The reality is that we had, I suppose, a generation of customers who cut their teeth on the more experimental side of things. And what we're seeing now is an industry response to that, where people are looking at streaming event platforms, event streaming platforms, and they're going, do you know what, we have to respond to this. The market is changing underneath us. We don't have a lot of time. Yes, we have smart people. But we know what we need to. This is going to be a 2 or 3 year program of work, and we need to make the right decisions now. Yeah. So within that context changes everything in terms of, you know, how you certainly how you think about interacting with a vendor, but also in terms of the value that the vendor can give you, right? Because now you're looking at something that is actually time critical. And as I said, it could be as a response to competition, it could be a change response to the business environment, or it could be, you know, just be about the fact that, you know, you have a market opportunity that you want to seize. And these things are usually time limited, right? So that's where we come in.
So yeah. And that's in the current era, with more mainstream companies adopting event streaming, as it has become a mainstream technology that basically everybody acknowledges is either a part of your present or your near future. Then you've got the shops that do expect a more complex arrangement with a professional services organization and all of those other higher level functions that you mentioned, and not just, you know, let us whiteboard for 2 days and then go away.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, that brings us to a sort of a misconception about what we do, right? Like we're not really about going in and drawing a bunch of stuff on whiteboards. And our whole thing is to actually get into the details of your business and guide the decisions that you're making in order to assure that you get a successful milestone achievement, right? That's really what it comes down to. One of the interesting things that I found about this particular technology versus some other technology platforms in the past, right? So I'm not talking specifically about anything messaging or integration related, but there were the time to value on event streaming seems to be, this is just a personal observation, that it seems to be a lot shorter than some of the other technologies, like data lakes, for example, right? Where you would go off and you would say, oh, do you know what? We're going to start a data lake project. Oh, that sounds excellent, right? What are you going to put in with data? What are you going to do with it? We'll work it out once we've done it. And you go off and you build a whole bunch of stuff, and you take a big pile of money and you throw it at the problem, and then you've got a data lake and you go, well, what do we do with it now? And you're like, oh, we're not really sure, right? Event streaming tends to follow a problem, right? There are many problems that can be solved with this technology, and the turnaround time for it is very quick. And because the turnaround time is very quick, the time to actually see realized value is very quick, right? Which is an exciting area to be working in, simply from the point of view that you do get to see your work and your influence make an impact in a very short amount of time. Right.
That is a fantastic insight. And that's actually not something I had considered previously, that time to value is shorter because everybody's trying to do a thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not like data lakes were unmoored from any business goals, but it was a little fuzzier, like, hey, we want all our analytics to be better.
Who doesn't want better analytics, right?
I want better. I mean, it's like you're a company and your mission statement is you want better analytics and your bitter competitor wants worse analytics. You know, it's not how it works.
Absolutely not.
Nobody is like that.
Yeah.
So, but the value, time to value is shorter, you're saying, which is just such a businessy term. I like that. I'm going to try to say it as many times as I can in this podcast. Time to value. This is Winnie the Pooh in the tuxedo with the monocle when he says time to value.
For sure.
Because there's always a thing that they're trying to get done that is crisp and is a clearly defined business initiative.
Yeah,
or something like that.
And I think the really interesting thing about this is how viral this platform actually is. We often see that there is that this gets implemented for a single line of business to solve a crisp problem, and someone else is actually in the company doing a similar thing where they're like, oh, actually, you know what? We're doing some streaming stuff as well, right? Maybe we can leverage the same hardware or the same deployment, or maybe share some of the same approaches. All of a sudden, you start sharing data with each other, right? And it's quite interesting to see how that tends to snowball, right? Fascinating stuff.
So as we see things like transition to cloud and just the general greater mainstreamness of event streaming, which is certainly something that I see happening, how does your organization respond to that in a formal way? Like, do your the structure of your engagements change? Do they get longer, shorter? What do you do differently?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a number of different things. We've broken our offerings out previously over a design, build, and operate type cycle. That we've got sort of short term engagements for things like architecture workshops, health checks, deployments, upgrades, streaming application design, all of that sort of stuff. But as the customers require more additional help, right, we've had to move to a model where we can support that through longer term engagements, through things like resident solutions architectures engagements, which is longer, looking at weeks, sometimes in the space of a couple of months worth of work. Again, we're not a consulting company. We're a software company, and we want to make sure that you realize that you realize the value of your investments quickly, right? And in order to facilitate that, what we've had to do is go back and ask ourselves, what is it that customers actually want to do? And that's a very difficult question to answer at face value, simply because customers often don't know, right? So we've had this idea around the company that we've been talking about quite a bit, which is this notion of a streaming maturity model. And the streaming maturity model is this idea that there are these five different phases, right? So you start off with some developer interest, bit of prototyping. You move to a streaming pilot or early production. So this is, you're looking at one line of business, one department going off and building something. And then, once you move beyond that, you're looking at multiple lines of business, right? So you're looking at like SLA-ready integrated streaming. Then we move on to like global streaming, where you've got like multiple regions. And then eventually, if your company is interested in doing this thing, the idea of an event streaming platform is a central nervous system, right? Effectively, a stream all the things. And we went about trying to work out what exactly is it that customers need at every single one of these layers or every single one of these levels. And we've broken that down into something that we term the adoption framework. And the adoption framework is really a grouping of topics that you need to consider at a particular level in order to be successful with the product on those terms, right? So for example, if you're at level one, you're prototyping something, etc., you just really need to know the basics, right? So how do partitions work, basic producer consumer stuff, topic and schema design, that kind of thing. When you move up to level three, which is what we see a lot of customers at that level, you're looking at things like, okay, well, how do I do topic governance, right? How do I run my stuff in multiple data centers? How do I do things like infrastructure as code? How do I deal with information security? As you move to level four, again, it levels up. And, then you start, talking about things like platform auditing, or things like policy as code. So for example, if you've got a whole bunch of governance stuff and you don't want humans involved, how do you get systems to apply those governance criteria on an automated basis? So we have a clear idea of the sorts of things that customers need to be thinking about. And we can have a discussion with that sort of an endpoint in sight. And you might not necessarily want to do all the things within that within that particular level, but there's certainly areas that you need to consider, right? And in so doing, we've taken the experience of working with hundreds of different customers and gone, well, what exactly is it that you need to do in order to be successful? And that depends on whether it's implementation or governance or monitoring or security, right? And I think it ties in quite nicely into something that you asked me at the beginning, which was, what about if you're a terrible software company? Isn't it actually in your interest to just sell loads of professional services, right? That's how that was framed. And the way that we think about this entire thing is we're trying to solve problems, right? Because we're pushing at the boundaries of the product. What we're doing is we're providing field insight. And that's going back to our product teams as we evolve. So as we're the objective of the overall thing is to make the product better. It's to take some of the things that are having to be done manually, right? The customers are having to build custom things for, and say, well, why shouldn't that be part of the product, right? And the objective is to make the overall thing, more valuable, easier to use, and to make it easier to own and live with, right? So from that point of view, the adoption framework that we've built is really it's a never-ending project, right? It's an ongoing process of refinement that we're looking at in terms of like, what do customers need? How do we go about delivering it? You know, what sort of outcomes, objectives, collateral do they need, etc. And then the second part of it is, you know, which parts of those things shouldn't they be doing, right? Which parts of those things shouldn't they need to worry about? Because a lot of this stuff is complex, and you'd just much rather that, it came out of the box.
Exactly. And following up on that issue that we talked about earlier, you know, why not just make the product terrible so that you can sell more professional services? When you look at the financial metrics, and this is, I think, an unfortunate fact about the business you're in, it's never as good to be a consulting company as it is to be a product company. Like, maybe you can run a cloud service with worse margins if you're not very good at it, but you can't really have an on-prem subscription enterprise software product that returns a lower return on capital than consulting. So like, consulting is the worst business that you can be in.
Absolutely.
And you don't want more of it. You want to do it because you want to help people succeed. That's what you do. It's not really about the money. It's about helping people be more successful with the product. And is it about the money and selling a product? Well, of course, you know, those businesses exist to do that kind of thing. But you, the point is, you have to make the product the best thing and most valuable thing it can be. You have to make the experience of adopting the product the best and most valuable thing it can be. Or people are going to pick something else. And even if there isn't really a viable alternative to Kafka in the mainstream right now, there are alternatives to event streaming. You know, you could pick some other kind of architecture and be successful with it if it just hurts so bad to use Kafka. So yeah, we don't do that. No. I mentioned when we got started that I wanted to talk about trends. And you're out there, as we've discussed, not just in different companies, but whole different industries, people trying to get different kinds of things done within industries. So you see a pretty broad cross-section of the development and software architecture landscape. So if you are a developer or an architect out there wanting to know what's going on, if you were imagine talking to that person, what would you tell them? What trends do you see in the last, say, year?
What trends do I see? A really interesting trend that I've been seeing of late has actually been a move away from orchestration to choreography. Now, for people who
these please describe the difference between those things.
So these are sort of words that are bandied about in architecture circles. So the way that I describe it is that orchestration is an approach to managing business process where you have a central conductor for an orchestra, and they tell everybody what to play at any given point in time. Choreography, on the other hand, is much like having a choreographer in a ballet, in that the choreographer works out with all the players as to what they're going to be doing at any given point in time. And then they let them go and do all of this, their own thing, you know, by themselves. And so what we're seeing as a sort of a general trend is a move away from centralized business process management to decentralized choreography platforms that are based on microservices, which coordinate with each other based on event streaming, which is a really interesting change, right? And we're seeing this across manufacturing. We're seeing this in order fulfillment. Things like loan applications, trade settlement and investment banks. Generally, complex business processes, right? And the motivations for this vary, and it could be anything from vendors cutting support and pushing for migration to other products, which we do see a lot with certain portfolio companies that have a number of different products that play in the same space. Or we've got situations where existing systems are unable to handle the volume of things that are, that you know, need to be managed, or where the systems themselves become difficult to change, right? Where the release processes themselves are cumbersome. In order to make any change, you need to redeploy everything. Everything needs to be retested. People do see this as a burden. They want to reduce the operational cost.
People definitely see that as a burden. Yeah. That's the worst possible. You've taken on all of the disadvantages and costs of Microsoft.
The disadvantages, right? So like,
and pretty much not the one advantage.
No, not at all, right? So I mean, there's some advantages to doing this, right? It's decentralized, so your teams are independent and they focus on their bits and they can deploy all these things separately. It's easy to add what I refer to as ancillary functionality through something that we've termed observer systems, right? So these are services that sit on the periphery of the actual main business process, and they perform additional functionality, right? So things like SLA checkers, right? So systems that actually measure your service levels to see are you exceeding them or not. Right, process monitors. We're seeing things like monitoring consoles. Right, and the reasoning for all of this sort of stuff is sort of driven by the challenges around moving to this type of architecture, right? Because in as much as it's nice to decentralize everything, the cost of doing that is that you lose some of the advantages of having a central conductor to the overall process, right? So you've got no central view on things like where orders are up to, right? You can't visualize the overall workflow because different bits of the workflow are actually in different parts of the system as a whole, right? In doing so, I mean, we've actually had to develop our own diagramming notation to be able to communicate and reason about these types of systems, right? And I think one of the other sort of interesting bits around this is actually how do you go about getting integration with all of the things, right? Here we're talking not only legacy systems such as mainframes, but we're also talking about databases. You know, we have to reason about things like consistency patterns, are these systems the publishing events in such a way that a failure at the wrong point in time couldn't cause downstream stuff to change, while they see a different state? We often talk to customers about things like CDC and that type of tooling. But then we also have to integrate with all sorts of really unusual things as well, and we have to monitor their stability, and we also have to make sure that we don't do system replays, and some of this stuff gets really weird. Like there was one company one financial services company that I was working with, where they had to integrate with fax machines because some of their counterparties that they were trading with received orders they received instruction to make payment by fax. And they wanted to make sure. We want to make sure that we're not sending multiple faxes, right? So it's definitely an interesting set of problems, and I'm curious to see how we iteratively go about solving for this.
I think the most exciting thing, trend in there that you said was the transition from orchestration to, orchestration to the other word you used,
to choreography.
Choreography, yeah. It was so exciting.
Yeah,
I literally forgot 50% of the words. The transition from that's how hyped I was from orchestration to choreography, and that is, I think, a more compact way of describing an architectural paradigm that I spent a fair amount of time evangelizing, which is this idea of microservices interacting through Kafka topics. Services that receive some external stimulus, whether it's from a topic or a REST endpoint or something, do some computation, produce a result to a topic, which is then picked up by other services. And that choreography happens through those topics. And what you get is this much more emergent system or a system in which value and behavior can emerge from those little pieces interacting. Now, just to check myself a little bit, the way we use emerge and the way we use the word evolutionary when we're talking about architecture, I think betrays some things in that it still takes a lot of really difficult effort by a lot of really intelligent and creative people. So much so that it's even worthwhile to have a whole business unit dedicated to helping them, which is why you're on the show. So it's not like this stuff just happens. You know, Skynet does not pop out of a Confluent platform cluster. It's hard, but with that choreography approach to things, organizations can, you know, you get emergent value from new services being created by people in the organization, where maybe the original creators of that topic or the original author of the service that produces data to that topic didn't envision that thing happening. Now, with orchestration, it's not really planned. You don't get that. But it's with choreography, it's not centrally planned. And so you do get emergent functionality. It's more like an ecosystem or a marketplace than some top-down thing. So it's exciting that you see that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is, these things are big changes, right? And this is part of the reason that people do engage with us, because what we're doing is we're pushing the nature of their businesses using this technology of event streaming in a way that's uncomfortable, right? And the primary value of working with us around this is, you know, when I ask customers about, you know, why they've chosen to work with us at this point in time, it comes down to two phrases that I hear all the time, right? And it is comfort and reassurance, right? And part of it is because, you know, the business is changing in a way that's making you uncomfortable, and you don't know what you don't know, right? Is the thing that we're building going to be resilient? Are we building the right thing? Are we thinking about these problems in a way that actually makes sense, right? And customers want to know that when they're going about like building these things, that they're not constructing something that's really hard to change down the line, and that they're making a bunch of decisions that are going to be costly to rework, right? And this is something that you get with any new technology, right? And it just comes down to not knowing what you don't know, right? So in lieu of that, they come to us and we help them to build up a good foundation that takes the future into account, right? And that future might be, you know, more business lines coming on board. That might be, you know, moving to multiple regions. Tim, you mentioned about what are the sorts of drivers out there. You know, like a couple of years ago, we were doing mainly on-premise work. Now we're doing a lot of hybrid cloud deployments. We're talking multi-cloud. There's a tremendous amount of complexity around this, and it's not easy. It's not easy around all of this stuff.
My guest today has been Jacob Karab. Jacob,
perfect.
Thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Great. Thank you very much. Cheers.
And there you have it. Hey, it's Kafka Summit time again, and you get another discount code for listening all the way to the end. Kafka Summit London is coming up on April 27th and 28th of 2020, and you can get 30% off your registration if you go to kafka-summit.org and use the discount code KSL20AUDIO during checkout. Just enter KSL20AUDIO while registering at kafka-summit.org, and that 30% off is all yours. I would love to see you there. And anyway, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss the podcast or ask a question, you can reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's at TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out to us in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to join that group. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. If you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.